I suspect that we are all familiar with the reference to our national flag as Old Glory. And for many of us, that brings back images, memories, occasions where we've seen that flag in certain contexts. We've recently gotten back from a visit to Washington, D.C., and saw flags in many places, one of which particularly stands out is the raising of the flag at Iwo Jima, and seeing that, saw it at night when the lights were shining on it, and had a particular grand view of it. But we know that a flag represents a country or an organization. And we have looked back at our history, and we think about our flag and what is represented by it and what our nation has been through and what it has lived for and accomplished. And there's a sense of national fervor that is raised from that as we think about particular times and occasions, like during and after World War I, World War II, and the occasion after the 9/11 tragedy, where there was a sense of nationalism that was stimulated from that, the flag held greater significance for many, and many people put that flag out, indicating their support and encouragement in light of the circumstances. But today, we're experiencing occasions from certain elements where the reverence for our national flag is seriously waning. And actually, the revere for our country itself seems to be waning. It causes us to maybe wonder if the name that was used on a particular occasion in 1 Samuel, when bad things were happening to the nation of Israel, when a child was born and was given the name Ichabod, the glory has departed. And we wonder and hope that we're not there, but there are signs that maybe cause us to wonder. Why is this happening in our nation? What exactly is going on? Why is there a disposition among certain elements of our population that downplay our national identity and focus rather on world unity? But that has been the case, and we've seen that somewhat growing over the years. And maybe you've wondered, does this change in attitude indicate a fundamental change of mindset in a positive or a negative direction? Well, it's not a hard question. It's not positive. Not how I view things. Now, if you have a globalist mentality, you might be led more to think that, well, you know, we shouldn't think so much about our own nation. You know, all nations, you know, should be, you know, just recognized and all of that, and downplay that. Well, there may be a place for that. But we may want to think about, well, why is this happening in our nation at this time? Why is this mindset changing? Well, it's undoubtedly because there's a shift at a deeper level than meets the eye. There's a departure from a biblical worldview where we in the past have had a shared understanding of a transcendent reality, something, someone outside of ourselves, above us, to whom we are accountable. We would say that's talking about God. And even in a pluralistic society, there has been in the past a greater appreciation and understanding of that, but that has been changing, and that is less the case. And there's been a greater focus on man's accomplishment, on humanistic thinking, and ignoring or denying that God has any active role in the world. And our society is becoming very much like the people of the Babel Tower Project. Remember what happened there? It was a matter of, let's all stick together, lest there be forces that come upon us to push us out into the whole world, and we lose our identity, the name that we're building for ourselves. And who were they resisting? Well, they were resisting God, because God had specifically said, go out into the all the earth, multiply, fill the earth, subdue it. And so there's this one world human governance emphasis. And with that is an anti-nationalistic mindset, which are essentially in opposition to God's expectations, how he has set things up and ordained things to be. It is a resistance to God's spiritual focus within nations. And that's how he has functioned. That's what his work has been. And we are to be his stewards for good. So we think about nations. The Bible talks about people from all tribes, tongues, and nations. There's an expectation that nations are part of the equation. So is it okay to have a nationalistic sense or appreciation? Well, it appears to be so. Certainly, that was the case with most nations historically. But what about when we see nations self-destructing, as we have seen historically? We're drawn to ask why that is so and what should be done. And we see a familiar pattern in the history of Israel. And there are lessons to be learned from this familiar example that I trust we will recognize and take to heart. Because in our passage today, there's an illustration that's being given of one nation for the benefit of another nation. That is, the nation Israel, the northern kingdom, is being used as an example for the southern kingdom to whom Isaiah was directly speaking. And so that's where we look to Isaiah 28 today. And what we observe is the tragic descent from grandeur. Looking at the first couple of verses, it says, "Woe to the crown of pride, to the drunkards of Ephraim, whose glorious beauty is a fading flower, which is at the head of the verdant valleys, to those who are overcome with wine. Behold, the Lord has a mighty and strong one, like a tempest of hail and a destroying storm, like a flood of mighty waters overflowing, who will bring them down to the earth with his hand." And so, first observation is to note, when it's talking about Ephraim, it's not just talking about the one single tribe. It's using that as, because it was sort of centrally located and had some significance in the northern kingdom, it's often used as a term for the whole northern kingdom, which is the case here. And reference to the valley and all of that is just identifying its physical location, thinking about the capital of Samaria and where it's located in the valley there. And then we come to the next couple of verses, and you'll see there are several phrases that are repeated associated with the same thing, and I think it's for emphasis. So as we look at verses 3 and 4, it says, "The crown of pride, the drunkards of Ephraim, will be trampled underfoot, and the glorious beauty is a fading flower, which is at the head of the verdant valley, like the first fruit before summer, which an observer sees, he eats it up while it is still in his hand." And that's kind of the idea of it's going to come to judgment. And so it's talking about Ephraim, talking about the northern kingdom. So what we observe is the glory of Ephraim will be wiped away in divine judgment. Now, we've seen references to that before. we've noted that Isaiah was a prophet to the southern kingdom, to Judah, but frequently references not only a host of other nations that are around this area who will see judgment, but also the northern kingdom as well as the southern kingdom. And it is to prepare, to help, encourage, direct, and warn the southern kingdom from all of these things. So what also do we see here? Well, the iniquity of Ephraim will result in being brought down. Well, there's something in particular that's to be noted here. First of all, the section is introduced by woe, and that's used in many other of the prophecies of the Old Testament, particularly in Isaiah. It's in chapters 5, several times in chapter 6 as well. It's a term of lament and threat. It expresses emotion, and it's particularly directed toward the leaders of Ephraim in the northern kingdom of Israel. And the reason for this woe to them, this warning to get their attention, was because of their pride. Now, we've observed time and time again in our study of Isaiah, as well as other places in Scripture, the problem that pride has been. And on our list of serious sins, pride rarely gets a top billing. But for the Lord, that's always on top. Does that make you wonder? Are we confused? I mean, you think about what's going to be on your top 10 list of sins. Now, you don't have to turn it in. But just think about it. What's on that list? Where is pride? Well, when we think about a list like that, we're proud that we don't do any of those things to start with, right? What does that tell us? We've failed the test already. We're in big trouble. So the source of iniquity comes from the pride, because what pride is that we lift ourselves up above essentially everything, including God. And that's the difficulty that is raised. But I want to take just a moment and look at a couple of other passages that relate to this woe idea and the iniquity that was associated with Ephraim or the northern kingdom. And Amos chapter 4, verse 1 says, "Hear this word, you cows of Bashan, who are on the mountain of Samaria, who oppress the poor, who crush the needy, who say to the drunkards, 'Bring wine, let us drink.'" I remember this verse when I was in high school. I went to a Christian school, and when I was in high school, I had a course in 10th grade on the minor prophets. And to think that I can even remember that is amazing. But I remember this particular verse because our teacher, Mr. Vanderbeen, graphically communicated and portrayed this verse and talked about the fat cows of Bashan as talking about the women of this time. And I thought, that's kind of rude. Isaiah, or Amos in this case, to be talking that way and saying to their husbands, "Bring wine, let us drink." Well, then it continues in chapter 4. Several other woes are noted in Amos. In chapter 6, verse 1, it says, "Woe to you who are at ease in Zion and trust in Mount Samaria, notable persons in the chief nation, to whom the house of Israel comes." Then dropping down to verse 3, "Woe to you who put far off the day of doom." In other words, you think this isn't coming on you. "Who cause the seat of violence to come near, who lie on beds of ivory, stretch out on your couches, eat lambs from the flock, and calves from the midst of the stall, who sing idly to the sound of stringed instruments, and invent for yourself musical instruments like David, who drink wine from bowls, and anoint yourselves with the best ointments, but are not grieved for the affliction of Joseph. Therefore they shall go down captive as the first of the captives, and those who recline at banquets shall be removed. And the Lord God has sworn by himself, the Lord God of hosts says, 'I abhor the pride of Jacob and hate his palaces. Therefore, I will deliver up the city and all that is in it.'" This is Amos talking to the northern kingdom. That's who he was speaking of, and he gives a little more graphic detail and certainly coincides with what Isaiah is referencing here as he is talking to Judah about Ephraim or the northern kingdom. And so that rather makes it clear, and what he's basically saying is, you were living like you were kings, and the Lord is going to put you in your place because your pride has elevated you. You think you are not accountable, that you can do whatever you want. And guess what? That's not going to happen. Well, we don't have to think real hard to see some correlation between the imagery that's communicated there and what we see in our own nation. We have a lot of the same kind of thing. I'm not going to go into all of the details because we don't have time to do that, but let me just point out the next element here. The iniquity of Ephraim will result in being trampled. That's the second part, looking at verses 3 and 4. The pride and the reference here to drunkenness, which will be elaborated on later, it's repeated. It's reemphasized. And it's pointing out that there's an aggressive nation that the Lord is arranging to come and be the one who is going to bring judgment upon this northern kingdom. And this would happen in Isaiah's lifetime, 722 B.C. Remember, Isaiah lived and ministered roughly 740 to 681 B.C. 722 is right in the middle of that. And Isaiah is noting, Judah, you need to watch out. You need to recognize this is going to be happening with the northern kingdom, with your brethren, Israel, and it's going to be happening to you also if you don't change your life. Get it together. And so it's a lesson for them as well as for us to take heed lest you fall. Then verses 5 and 6 of Isaiah 28, in that day the Lord of hosts will be for a crown of glory and a diadem of beauty to the remnant of his people. Now here we want to just simply quickly recognize that on the one hand he's saying the glory that Israel had been experiencing is going to be fading, deteriorating, and going away. But the time will come when there will be a remnant from you, and the Lord will be the glory for them. Verse 6, for a spirit of justice to him who sits in judgment, and for strength to those who turn back the battle at the gate. So here we note the remnant of Ephraim will be exalted in future restoration. The Lord will be the source of glory and beauty for the remnant. In that day is looking at a time when Ephraim would fall and the Lord would preserve a remnant from this people and ultimately would be materializing in the future kingdom that is to come. Though there may be some elements before, but the northern kingdom really never did well in coming back. It was polluted, if you will, because people were taken out and spread around. Other nations were brought in and then intermarried with the remnant, and that's where we have the reference to the Samaritan in the New Testament, where they were a people that the Jews who considered themselves pure Jews wanted nothing to do with. So in this case, in anticipating this future time when there would be a remnant that would be preserved, the Lord would be the glory of them and the beauty of them. And then the Lord would be the source of justice and strength for this remnant as well. He would become the standard, the facilitator of justice for the judges, the strength for the soldiers. And that doesn't mean that the faithful Ephraimites would all of a sudden have everything they needed to overturn their enemies before the time, that is, before the anticipated coming kingdom of the millennium that was coming, but they would find all that they needed in the Lord that they had not recognized and accepted previously. So this is an element of hope in this message of judgment. And it's reminiscent of the various occasions in Scripture where we see judgment is pronounced, but grace and mercy are also communicated. Even thinking about the flood, when the judgment of the flood came, and Noah preached for 120 years during the time of the preparation of the ark, in warning in advance what is coming. We see examples of that frequently. Then the tragic effects of substance abuse. Now that sounds a little too contemporary, doesn't it? What people do to get an altered state of consciousness and all the rest. Notice what verse 7 says. But they also have erred through wine, through intoxicating drink, are out of the way. Now, out of the way is probably not the best translation. Others translate stumble. The idea is that you're not staying on track. You're falling off the path. The priest and the prophet have erred through intoxicating drink. They are swallowed up by wine. They are out of the way. Again, that same thing. They stumble through intoxicating drink. They err in vision. They stumble in judgment. The Net Bible states it this way. Even these men stagger because of wine. They stumble because of beer. They wanted to make it a little more contemporary. Priests and prophets stagger because of beer. They are confused because of wine. They stumble around because of beer. They stagger while seeing prophetic visions. They totter while making legal decisions. That gives you a little more context, in a sense. So what we observe here is the people and leaders are out of control. It's a general statement first, which seems to focus on the people, and then a more specific statement seems to be focusing on the leaders of the people. And I take it that this is referring to, again, to Israel, not Judah. Judah is going to be referenced later, but I think there's reason to believe that this is still talking about those of Israel, and as a lesson for those of Judah who will be referenced just a little bit later. The defining characteristic of the day was intoxication. Now, how would you like to have that as the thing that is going to be in the headlines of the newspaper? America is noted for drunkenness. America is known for its drug problems. Well, is that true? I'm afraid so. Well, this is, Israel is known for its drunkenness. It's not far off. You can certainly see the correlation there. And it covers both the softer drugs and the harder drugs, if you will. The wine, the strong drink, and the resultant stumbling and staggering and unclear thinking and improper behavior. The idea is they're not well controlled and not particularly sensible. And in our society today, we see ample evidence of that, and it is intensifying. And that drug problem is devastating on so many levels, and it is not going away. It's a tremendous social and economic problem. I mean, if you think about the amount of money in that whole drug culture coming and going, it's amazing. And what the effects of drugs on society in terms of moral implications, economic implications, and the destruction of lives. It's amazing, and hardly any of us don't know somebody who's been directly affected. And so it's a serious problem. And this people were dealing with the same kind of issue. The text also indicts the religious leaders of the day. Now, fortunately, our leaders don't have any problems with any of these kinds of things, right? Well, not so. There's a lot of problem with a lot of these things, and it's disturbing. And you go in any leadership level in any particular area, and you're going to find problems. It's so pervasive. And it's just an indication of how society deteriorates, degenerates, the further it gets from a biblical foundation, the further it gets from an acknowledgement that there is a God to whom we're accountable. And so we see that happening. And it's just a reminder that we have to recognize that we're vulnerable in this society, and we need to take steps to see that we're not also affected to the same degree by these very same ravages. And then there's another verse that you might not want to put on your list of memory verses because it's just not that edifying. For all tables are full of vomit and filth, no place is clean. That's not particularly encouraging, but a reality. Their living environment was defiled and filthy. And thinking about this, the damages of substance abuse, whichever kind you want to deal with, go very deep and wide. I'm reminded of when I was in a high school, a ninth grade in particular. I was living in Michigan, and our family had just moved from one house to another house. We were actually living in the basement because the upstairs wasn't finished yet, but we were close. And there was an accident just up the street. And the house that we were living in was about five houses closer to the intersection where this accident occurred. And because we were downstairs, we didn't hear it, but my dad did. It was late enough at night that us kids were in bed already. And in the morning, we found out that there were five people in a car that were hit by a drunk driver. Three of those kids were in my class. There were two kids that were killed. One was the older brother of one of the kids that was in my class. He was the driver. And then a neighbor girl, she was killed. And so there was a boy named Ron and two girls, Sharon and Marilyn, who Marilyn was pretty seriously hurt, and it was months before she was doing better. Sharon was thrown out of the car, and Ron wasn't particularly seriously damaged, but my dad went there and saw this accident. But I remember it kind of hit hard that this had happened so close to home. I mean, within just a few hundred yards, and it was people that we knew, and this would affect our class to a significant degree. And I think about others that I knew that were similarly hurt seriously from drunk drivers. In one case, someone that I knew who was killed because he was drinking, and on and on. And that's just a little teeny tiny blip in my memory of my experience, and you multiply that times all of the different people and what they have observed and what has been going on over multiple numbers of years. So the personal damages are substantial and disturbing. And we know that the physical impact of ingesting drugs has serious implications. And one of them is vomiting, where the body is attempting to get rid of the poison. Well, it's a whole lot better to not put the poison in the first place to eliminate that problem. And no one plans to get messed up on drugs of any sort, but that's often the result. And that's disturbing. And to think that there are people who want to legalize more and more, that's a little disturbing as well. I'm not sure that's going to help. I understand the arguments, but I don't think it's going to help. And besides, I prefer clear-headed thinking and clear-headed reality as long as it lasts, if you understand what I'm saying, other issues. Then the tragic neglect of sound teaching. Verse 9, whom will he teach? Now this is, you'll note in the text, it's as a quotation, and this is someone, probably the leaders of Israel, who are communicating this back to Isaiah, and that's how Isaiah is communicating it. Whom will he teach knowledge? And whom will he make to understand the message? Those just weaned from milk, those just drawn from the breasts? For precept must be upon precept, precept upon precept, line upon line, here a little, there a little. Now, what is this talking about? Well, the leaders rejected Isaiah's message as condescending. They are offended at Isaiah's simplistic teaching. They thought they were advanced in knowledge. They thought they had good understanding. They thought they did not need to be spoken to in this kind of way. And it's not unusual for arrogant and prideful people to feel they have all the answers, they're wiser than their teachers, and they don't need someone like some goofy prophet coming along and telling them what's happening, what they should do, what they shouldn't do. Not much has changed over the years. We're sort of in that place in our world today as well. They questioned just whom he thought he was addressing. They thought they should be treated as mature people, and they felt like he was talking to them as though they were babies or maybe toddlers, and felt like they were being talked down to. But that was not Isaiah's intent. Their problem was that they were prideful and arrogant. And they thought they were mature, but they were more immature than they realized. And they mocked Isaiah's presentation as mere babbling in simplistic phrases. Now here there's some difference of opinion as to how to take this, but I think there's some legitimacy to this. The Net Bible translates it, "Indeed, they will hear meaningless gibberish, senseless babbling, a syllable here, a syllable there." That may be a slight oversimplification, but it does communicate something of what the Hebrew is stating here. It's tsa la tsa, tsa la tsa, ka la ka, ka la ka. Well, you pick up, there's a sound there. If you were to translate as some do, this they would say it's do and do, rule on rule, or as we might say, blah, 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 blah. That's kind of the essence of what is communicated there. And so they just didn't want to hear that. Just leave me alone, let us do our own thing. And so they were refusing to take Isaiah's words seriously. You may recall Nehemiah, in about 250 years later, he says, For many years you had patience with them, this is speaking in his prayer to the Lord, and testified against them by your spirit in your prophets. Yet they would not listen, therefore you gave them into the hand of people of the peoples of the lands. That's Nehemiah 9:30. Nehemiah is picking up the very same thing that they needed to know. And then verses 11 and 12, "For with stammering lips and another tongue, he will speak to this people to whom he said, 'This is the rest with which you may cause the weary to rest, and this is the refreshing,' yet they would not hear." So here the leaders rejected Isaiah's message of warning. Isaiah here pointed out that some babbling would be coming that they would soon hear. They wouldn't want to hear. He essentially is saying, so you think you hear babbling? Just wait till the Assyrians come upon you and you don't know their language and they're going to come and take care of you in a way that you don't want to be taken care of. And they would experience a rest that they didn't want. That is, the land will be given rest from them, and they will be given a rest from being free to enjoy the land. Though if they had obeyed, they would have experienced true rest that the Lord offers, but they rejected and resisted. And then verse 13, "But the word of the Lord was to them, precept upon precept, precept upon precept, line upon line, here a little, there a little." that they might go and fall backward and be broken and snared and caught. And so here, the leader's rejection would result in national captivity. The word of the Lord was received as mere babbling. That's essentially saying the word should have been received as divine truth. It should have been received in humility. It should have been received as one truth building on another in a progression, which if you look at the phraseology there, it can be understood as communicating that. But they simply blew God's word off, and Isaiah with it is more blah, 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 instead of taking the word to heart. Now, I can't help but think about our own nation, our own context. How many times when someone communicates something of God's truth and people say, blah, 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 and blow us off. It's all too real. The result of rejecting truth is regression and captivity. There is judgment coming, and recognize that. And then just a quick note, we're not going to take the time to look at verse 14, but verse 14 says, "Therefore, hear the word of the Lord, you scornful men who rule this people who are in Jerusalem." There's we'll pick up there next time. You see the distinction. He's been looking at Israel as an example. Now he's coming to Judah. He says, "Therefore, these people didn't hear the word of the Lord. Look what's happening to them. Now you better listen." Well, that ought to be an example for us as well, to take the word of the Lord to heart, to take it seriously. And that's what we are urged to do. And again, there's a warning here. This is 100 years before the captivity happens to Judah. And it's an exhibition of God's grace. And giving this warning is part of that grace. And we experience God's grace as well